Welcome to Prophecy Radio, the Percy Jackson podcast that will keep you up to date on all things Rick Riordan and Rick Riordan Presents, including upcoming books, adaptations, and more.
This is episode number 122.
My name is Karen.
I'm Kristen.
And I'm Danielle.
What?
I am crashing.
We're very excited.
This is so surprising. We didn't plan out that intro at all.
No. We definitely didn't talk about that.
No.
As promised, our very special guest is Danielle, who has been our long... I was trying to figure out how long we've known each other at this point.
2013.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I joined Hypeable on International Women's Day 2013.
Nice. That's easy to remember, at least. Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. So it's officially been 11 years. Wow. That's pretty awesome, but also makes me feel kind of old. But hey, right. that's what we're doing here at the podcast.
We're two old ladies.
Two old ladies talking about our Percy friend Jackson. except this week, we're going to talk about Percy Jackson, but we are going to be discussing A Drop of Venom by Sajni Patel. Finally, we've been talking about this book forever, and we finally, you know, the stars aligned, and we are now here talking about this book. And we had to bring Danielle on because I felt like she was a great person to talk about this. And it has been a really long time since we've podcasted together. So it was time.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It was beyond time. I'm very excited to be here and be able to actually contribute to a Percy Jackson podcast.
That's exciting. Mm-hmm. We will be picking Danielle's brain about season one here in a minute. But in the meantime, as always, if you would like to contact us, you can do so at Prophecy Podcast on Twitter, at Prophecy Radio Podcast on Tumblr, Instagram, Threads, and Facebook, and prophecyradiopodcast@gmail.com. You can also join Prophecy Radio Reading Room on Facebook, which is our private Facebook group where we will be talking about books centered around mythology, and we will be having a discussion about A Drop of Venom in there at some point when I post something in there.
When we stop having crazy life things happening at the same time. We promise, we will talk about it.
It's been very busy, and I'm trying to just go with the flow. I'm trying to relax and not worry about things.
Good goal.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's pretty solid.
Pretty difficult for me, to be honest. But for now, let's talk about news and updates, because there's a couple of very exciting things that came out recently. First and foremost, Percy Jackson Funkos.
Right?
I mean, come on.
I mean, it's like they wanted us to slip back into our, like, super fandom time roots when Karen and I were hunting down Funkos like it was our job.
Yeah.
Coming up with, like, bags and bags of them at conventions and stuff.
Right. I have so many, and I don't have any of them out, I don't think. I mean, Chewie's sitting on my shelf because I couldn't actually find his box, so he kind of got transported naked when we moved, and most of the other ones are in boxes, so they're not out anywhere. But
from where I'm sitting right now, I have four out. Sora from Kingdom Hearts, Sven, I have a Belle one that I got from Disney Movie Insiders, and then Moana with her, like, headdress.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Those are some solid choices.
Yeah. But I have, like, a giant box of them in the garage that someday I'll have shelves and I will put them on shelves.
Yeah, that's what I'm hoping to do too. But so even though I haven't bought a Funko in a while, definitely gonna buy these 100%. Looking forward to all the variants too, because I need them all. Mm-hmm. Obviously
you definitely are a completionist.
I am. It's
especially
so
when it comes to Percy Jackson.
Yes.
Yeah, definitely. And another thing we can add to our collection is the Percy Jackson cookbook, yes, which I'm not surprised they're doing, but at the same time, kind of feel like that came out of nowhere.
Yeah, a little bit.
Like, the Funkos I really kind of felt were coming eventually, but then it was like, oh yeah, Percy Jackson cookbook. That's actually a good idea, considering, like, blue food is such a staple and stuff like that. And I feel like they could do some really interesting recipes with it, either, like, Greek food or just, like, fun plays on, like, certain characters and what they're, like, interested in.
Like Grover's enchiladas.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
Stuff like that. Yeah, I agree.
I don't, does Danielle probably doesn't know about Grover's enchiladas.
Nope. I barely even knew that blue food is a thing. So, you know, we're just learning.
Yeah.
But so, I will say that the cookbook looks really, really nice. That cover is really striking. And that food looks delicious.
It really does. And this is by Insight Editions, I think.
Oh, is it really?
Yeah. So they do a lot of fandom cookbooks, and their stuff is usually, like, really good quality. I have a few of the other ones, and we've covered some on the site before. Like, they have a really cool Disney one. I think they have, like, a Disney Villains one, Nightmare Before Christmas. They have a whole bunch of awesome ones. So I'm actually really looking forward to this.
Yeah, they do a lot of really great work. One of my best friends, Amy, actually used to work there.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's awesome.
So you should ask her about it the next time you see her. It comes up every once in a while. But yeah, they would always have the coolest stuff coming in out of their office. And they really took, in the last, like, I don't know, less than 10 years for sure, took a hard turn into fandom stuff. And they've been doing really well with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's so much room for, like, really interesting, like, spins on things. And people who want to do, like, themed, you know, dinner nights and parties and stuff like that. It's just a really, and it's always a great gift for somebody who's into that particular fandom.
I was going to say, yeah, I think the gift angle is huge because it's fun to get, like, a fandom themed cookbook. Plus, yes, then you can have movie theme nights and you'll have dishes that are in the cookbook ready to be made. And also us fandom completists, you know, we have to have all the things. So,
yes.
You know, I get it. I understand.
Speaking of collecting things, or maybe even people, like Infinity Stones, Danielle, I don't know. Did you ever watch Black Sails?
I didn't. I had seen a few people really raving about it, but I haven't gotten to it yet, no.
I've watched a few episodes at this point. I feel like it does have a lot of potential. I feel like it's got some Pirates vibes, so, like, I feel like the crossover for you would be pretty good, yeah. Especially Luke Arnold's. He's giving Will a bit at times, I think. So
don't tell me that.
Yeah, I know. I know how to hook Danielle into things. But there's a lot of people on screen and behind the cameras from Percy Jackson, the showrunners, a couple of writers, some actors, the woman who played Medusa, the guy who plays Poseidon. They're all from Black Sails. And apparently a fan asked Luke Arnold during one of his lives if he would ever do Percy Jackson. And he said he totally would. Right now, he's just watching as a fan. He said it was really good. He really enjoyed it. But if they asked him to join, he definitely would. And I think he could fit in somewhere. I think they could make room for him.
I was going to say, he has an interesting look. I think he could definitely be a god. I don't know which one, but, like, I feel like he could fit into that.
My immediate thought was Hades, but obviously we already have a Hades. So, well,
I mean, this, if they've done anything, they've taken the book descriptions of characters and kind of tossed them out the window. So, like, he could make an interesting Apollo.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that would be fun. He doesn't necessarily give the blonde hair surfer dude vibes, but, like, I could kind of see Apollo in his look. So I'm like,
he's a pretty attractive man. So.
I was going to say, yeah, he's pretty, like, chiseled like a statue.
Right?
So
got that going for him.
I've never seen this man in my life, but he really does look like Will Turner, and I am on board with anything this man wants to do.
Okay, great. See, told you. I knew how to draw Danielle.
New fan.
Speaking of Danielle and Percy Jackson, one of the other reasons why we really wanted her on the podcast is because you've never read a Percy Jackson book, right?
Never in my life. Sorry.
So clearly we are not the best friends that I thought we were, but that's fine. No, I'm just kidding. It's not for everybody, and that's totally cool. But I was actually really interested in getting your take on season one, going in not really knowing a whole lot about the book. So what were your kind of like overall thoughts on season one? You said you have some notes.
There are more questions, but I will preface them by saying, like, going into this, I was a fan of Karen and Kristen. And so, like, there was already, like, that bar that was there. And then also, I had the experience of going to that Rick Riordan event with
yes.
you.
Oh, yeah.
Knowing absolutely nothing about anything that I was seeing, sitting front row.
Yes.
So that was a lot of fun. You know, I really enjoyed the series. There were a lot of things that, like, there were a lot of things that I needed explained to me, kind of, unfortunately. Like, there were threads that I know as a fan, if I were a fan, I would have seen it. Mm-hmm. And the way that I heard other fans, like, point them out or be like, yeah, this makes sense. This is great. And so, like, I love that. And I wish that was, like, my position. It was more of the, like, very baseline what's happening, like, story things that didn't quite click.
Yeah.
Okay. But I did think that the kids were extremely talented. The actor who played Percy was fantastic. I loved his mom. I loved Gabe, and apparently I wasn't supposed to. Didn't realize that.
He's a lot worse in the book. So, yeah. Like, that's,
you know,
why
what?
Most people
I'm rooting
come
for
in
him. Like, I that's in. One of my questions.
Yeah.
So, like, my main question, if I may, just I selected a few of them.
Okay.
One, why is the horniest god in charge of children? And, like, the name Mr. D just sounds sexual. Why is this a thing?
He's being punished by Zeus because he was naughty.
Oh, uh-huh.
And so his punishment is to be in charge of a bunch of children.
Who he does not like.
He really hates children a lot.
Okay.
And he's Dionysus, so he's Mr. D, but you're right. It's not a great name.
Yeah.
I will also say he was also a favorite of mine and underused because Jason Mantzoukas is one of my loves.
Yeah.
So, like, that was another thing that really got me into, like, needing to watch the series was Jason. My second question is, like, a two-parter. Why is it that monsters dislike demigods? And why do the monsters presumably give up halfway through the season and, like, don't come back?
Monsters and demigods are just, like, they're just at odds. Like, they're the opposite. You know, it's like
they're opposing forces.
Okay.
It's like the children of the Titans. Like, the monsters are kind of the children of the Titans versus the demigods are the children of the gods and humans. And so it's like they clash. Yeah, it's not necessarily like anything specifically happened necessarily. They're just opposing forces.
Okay. It's just kind of always been that way.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And there are some monsters, and you learn this like later on in other books, that are like less monstrous. And that was one of the things that they really played with in season one, was that monster is kind of subjective. And that's why we see like Medusa's story the way that we do. She is very different in the book. But yeah. What was the second part of the, oh, why do they just not come back? Some monsters can regenerate faster than others. So Mrs. Dodds coming back after being slain in the first episode, she can kind of come back really fast, but like the Minotaur, for example, can't.
Gotcha. And also, the second half of the season, I think, moves faster. So it's like maybe 2 days versus the first half of the season, I think, is like a couple more. It's like a week.
Yeah.
Got it. Yeah.
It's like a little more concentrated as you get to those last three episodes. And so they don't hit any monsters because it's less time.
Understood. Okay. Yeah. Because it was like very heavy. And then it was just like not at all.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what got me confused. And then I guess my last question is, and this is me just being dense, like I kind of know because I've seen Hercules, but like, why is Kronos coming back a bad thing? They never really state it except for like maybe the gods being dismantled. But with the way that they're portrayed in this, like, why is that bad?
It's bad because Zeus has his throne. He's king of the gods because he defeated Kronos. So Kronos is mad about that, and he wants his throne back. And they kind of, you definitely don't know this in season one, but like what Kronos wants to do is revert back to like older times when the gods were a little bit angrier, when they were like, they ruled differently.
Okay.
So it's definitely not a good thing for the current gods, the demigods, the human world.
Yeah.
Kronos is bad news.
Because, like, I got the thing about the world wars then start, and, like, that's not good. Like, we don't want that. But then I was like, but, like, Gabe has a point. I was so on board. It was a really weird scene, but, like, I was on board. And then later I found out I shouldn't have been, or that he was, like, the big bad all along. I was very wrong.
This is giving me loving Matt from Teen Wolf.
Great.
Yeah. Aww. Also not a good thing.
Great. Yeah. But yeah, so those were like the handful of my questions, but I did really enjoy it. I will be watching for season two. And I also just really like knowing more of the things that you guys love.
Yay.
I am really glad that you plan on watching season two. That's very exciting. Was there, so like, obviously there are some like knowledge gaps that you kind of wish they had filled in a little bit better for fans who hadn't read the books. Is there anything else that you want to see more of or that you would like to see improve in season two?
I know this is not possible because of the way that Greek mythology goes. But the thing that I would like to see improved is not moving around so much. It felt like a lot of just, it felt traveling. Like a lot of, we have to go here for the thing and then here and then here and then back here. I had no idea where we were for some of it, or like how we were getting places. I think that the focus on moving between so many different spaces took away from perhaps like developing the characters and their relationships a little bit more, or the world a little bit more. Cause like, I still don't know the purpose even of like Camp Half-Blood, because I know it's a big thing, but we spent less than an episode there, or like about an episode there.
Yeah.
And you'd built it up for me throughout the last 10, 11 years. And so I was like ready for it. And then I just didn't understand it. So I think spending more time in specific places rather than going all over the place is something that I would like to see, but that's not how Greek myths work. So,
yeah. The thing with season one in particular is that it's this quest across the country. And while they go on quests in future books as well, I think it's a little less like, let's go to this place and then this place and then this place. It's more like, I mean, I guess they were heading toward the underworld the entire time, but I feel like this one in particular, there's a lot of steps along the way, whereas the next ones, I don't feel like it's going to be quite as much. Although, who knows, you know, how much they'll change that, but for season two, I kind of feel like it could be a little more streamlined. Do you agree with that, Kristen?
Yeah, I was just kind of running through books two and three and, you know, onward in my head. And yeah, like, while we always kind of have a quest, because that's part of the whole thing, I do think that, like, if they take book two, season two, in a direction that I kind of expect them to, I think it'll be less, here are the places we went, and more like, this is the journey we're on. Rather than going from a bus to a train to a semi-truck to this to that as you're traveling, in the second one, you kind of have like one or two modes of travel, and then you're following with them more.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like it's
less disjointed. Yeah. I agree with that.
Yeah. Like it, and I figured that's kind of how this first season sort of needed to be. It's kind of how it seemed like and how it was laid out in those opening credits. Mm-hmm. But I think in your last episode that I just finished listening to like an hour ago, you were talking about how the show might even be better served with a longer season or something like that. And I don't know if, it doesn't seem like they've released any information on what that episode count is going to be. No. But it's possible that they'll learn from this season. And Disney has also been, I think, letting up on their very strict episode counts for original series. So it's possible that Rick would be one to push through that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Cross the fingers. And
yeah. Hope. One can hope. That would be really cool.
Yeah.
All right. I really want to get into A Drop of Venom by Sajni Patel, because this book, like I said, has been a long time coming, and I'm really excited to have this discussion with both of you, because I feel like we all are going to have a lot to say about this book and everything that happens in it. And with that, I just want to give everyone a really big warning that this discussion will deal with sexual assault that happens on the page in the book and a lot of violence. If you are not in a good place for that, please skip this episode. Please skip this discussion. You can check the show notes for the timestamps and jump right to the feedback if you're into that. Don't push yourself, because this book, there's a lot that happens in it, and most of it's not great. So that being said, we knew going into this, just with the discussion surrounding the publication of the book, that A Drop of Venom was basically going to be the story of Medusa, but with an Indian mythology kind of twist. So I guess I want to start off with Danielle. How familiar were you with the story of Medusa from Greek mythology? And how familiar are you with Indian mythology in general?
I took a course on Greek mythology my first semester of college, and that is the last time I studied it. I knew the vague details, but because it's a course in mythology, it was always told from not her point of view, or mm-hmm. like the details about her, aside from the fact that she had snakes in her hair and would turn people to stone. Like, that was the only thing that was really imparted. The show helped a little bit to like jog my memory on that stuff.
That's so great. Yeah.
As far as Indian mythology goes, nothing that I'm aware of.
Okay. And of course, we've done an episode on Medusa. We've talked about her a lot, both in the show and the books and mythology. We talked a bit about Indian mythology, talking about the Arusha books. And there were some things that kind of like popped up in my memory. I was like, oh, yeah, there was like a twist on this in the Arusha books. But of course, this being one of the Rick Riordan Presents YA books, this is leveled up a little bit. And yeah, a lot of the themes are a lot darker. But it's still nice to be able to connect those dots sometimes.
Yeah, for sure. Honestly, in addition, I've read one Arusha book, so mm-hmm. I have that. The only other like Indian mythology I've taken in has been through pop culture. So like, I was obsessed with A Little Princess, and I think that's more Hindu mythology than it is like Indian. I know those are kind of parallel sometimes, but I know Hindu mythology has very specific characters as well. Mm-hmm. So like, yeah, so I had a little bit of extra, but nothing that like super came into play in this book. But yeah, not a whole lot of knowledge here either.
We've talked about this book. We've kind of hyped it up a little bit. What were your expectations going in? Did you kind of know what you were getting into, or did it surprise you a little bit?
I was definitely surprised by some things.
Yeah.
It being the YA kind of step up in the Rick Riordan Presents imprint, because we read a lot of the middle grade stuff. We've read Bound and Dagger, which is pretty much the only other one, right?
I think so.
So far. Yeah.
Yeah.
Everything else has been middle grade. So like, you know, Bound and Dagger did have a few more mature themes, but nothing quite as abrupt as the themes in A Drop of Venom. So yes, I was definitely a little, you know, taken aback by some of the things that she put in this book. But I'm honestly, I was very impressed by how they were handled. It's definitely not easy to read in any form, but like, I feel like since this is something that happens in the world so prevalently, like we're constantly being bombarded with stories of celebrities and sports people and whatever, that this is, it's not something that kids can escape either. So I feel like it's honestly it starts you talking about these things. And I think Sajni handled it really well. Mm-hmm. So yeah, definitely a little more intense than I thought it was going to be in a YA book, but also I think handled very well.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. And then Danielle, so you went to that event with me where Rick did talk about it, because this book was about to come out or had just, I think it was about to come out.
The event was in October.
Okay.
It was in like early October. Yeah.
Yeah. And this came out in January. So it was a couple of months ahead of then. But how much did you know about the book going into it?
Going into that event? Nothing. And then you turned to me and said, you should read this. And I said, yes. but like outside of that, going into it, all I had was the synopsis, and I hadn't read any other Rick Riordan Presents books before, so I didn't quite know how they were going to be. But I do read a lot of YA, and like I have read a lot of YA, and I've read a lot of like YA borderline NA. Mm-hmm. And so my expectation to this going in was that it would be brutal and a hard read, and that it would be like talking up sort of rather than down.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And in that, I was kind of surprised, because to me, it felt like YA in terms of some things, like the brutality of it and the descriptions of mutilation or violence. And then in other ways, it felt very middle grade to me. And so there was an interesting dissonance happening. And I'm not sure if that's because they were bringing in like the telling of a mythology. But so yeah, my expectation was the brutality, and it kind of was a little bit different than expected.
Mm-hmm. I feel like I agree with that too, that there were some times when I was like, oh, this feels like it's skewing a little younger now. Like there were some instances, and that might've just been because Manisha in particular was like a little more naive to the world. So the way that she's kind of viewing things and experiencing things at some points kind of felt like that to me. And at others, you're right, it was definitely like a little higher up on the YA, like NA scale, new adult. I feel like maybe you were more prepared for the brutality than we were, because it kind of caught me off guard. I knew that this book was going to talk about sexual assault. I did not expect, but I'm very glad that that thread carried throughout the book, that it wasn't just like a one-time thing and then we kind of move past it. Like it deals with the entire spectrum of, you know, it happening and then the fallout specifically for her afterwards, and coming to terms with what happened and her anger and her sadness and her depression and all of that. So again, like Kristen said, I feel like that was really well handled. So yeah, I guess like always, we're going to talk about the book a bit spoiler free. I mean, we're going to talk about the basic premise and a couple of random things. And then there will be a small spoiler section to just talk about the end of the book. But the first thing I wanted to start off with was the main two characters. So the first one is Manisha, who is basically Medusa. And she is a Nagin. And from mythology, these are serpent princesses of striking beauty. And throughout the book, they kind of describe, you know, them as a race of people who kind of have some abilities and some connections to serpents. And, you know, not that we love talking about Harry Potter, but Nagini is, you know, related to this. If you've heard the name Nagini, then maybe seeing Nagin was like, oh, I kind of recognize that. So she and her family were forced to flee their home during the fire wars, and she was sent to be a priestess called an Apsara. And this is a celestial being in both Hindu and Buddhist culture, sort of like a cloud or water spirit. And this is one of the things that reminded me of Arusha, because Urvashi is an Apsara in the Arusha books. And basically, Manisha was sent there until her sisters could return for her, which, spoiler alert, I mean, this happens pretty early in the book, does not happen. And she's forced to kind of go on this journey. And the other thing I wanted to mention with Manisha is that she has this awesome golden snake named Noni, who ended up being like so much cooler than I thought she was going to be. Were you guys surprised by what actually came of this bracelet and all of that with Noni?
I mean, the RRP mythology of it all, I was not surprised. I very much saw it coming and was excited for it to happen. But I kind of loved that with this being like YA and kind of a step up from middle grade, that Noni wasn't like a talking sword. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like in the RRP books and in Rick's books, these little magical sidekicks seem to usually talk in some way, shape, or form. And I really liked that Noni like had a way of expressing and communicating with Manisha, but did not just like talk. I thought it allowed the whole story to be a little more mature. If it would have been a straight up middle grade book, Noni would have definitely talked.
Yeah.
But I really did enjoy how Noni kind of figured into the plot and how attached like Manisha and Noni came to be by the end.
Yeah, that's a great point. It's almost like if Noni had spoken, that it would have felt more like an ancient myth that is just kind of unrelatable versus something like this where you feel every bit of it, even if it is like a tale that is passed down. It feels more like it had happened rather than having like a talking snake would have maybe taken us out of that mindset or been a little bit at odds with the themes of the rest of the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It lends that just little bit more of like a realistic spin on it that I think, makes it more relatable.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have Pratyush, who is basically Perseus, and his father was a slayer, and so therefore so is he. It's passed down, and their whole purpose is to kill monsters, and every time they kill one, they gain another life, and they are much harder to kill than regular people. And his parents die, and the king basically takes him and uses him at will, treating him like an errand boy, sending him off after monsters, kind of taking credit for his accomplishments, even as he lauds him as this hero to the people and stuff. He treats him really badly. And I thought that this was really interesting because it puts these two characters on opposite ends. You know, they are meant to be enemies, and yet I feel like their lives are really not that different from each other. What face is that, Danielle?
At the beginning of this, you asked if there was like an expectation that I had, and if anything, like, didn't I forgot that I liked him fine as a character. I did not enjoy the inclusion of having him be so prevalent in the story and narrate half of it, and also have a backwards timeline or a different timeline with him.
Mm-hmm. I was actually going to mention the timeline because I really didn't like that in the beginning.
No.
Because my brain has trouble comprehending that, like trying to put the pieces together. I think near the end, as it started getting closer and closer, I actually liked it because it was like, oh, she was just here. We just saw this. And here he is coming, like, you know, 2 days later. And we kind of see what happened after she left. But before that, it was getting really confusing going back and forth and trying to figure out, like, when things were happening.
Agreed. I am a hater of flashbacks. I will always be a hater of flashbacks. I understand the necessity of them in a lot of stories, but they always drive me crazy because I don't care. Like, find another way to tell me about the past, because I don't want to go back and read a whole chapter that is from the past when I know it factors in, but like, I want you to tell me it some other way. And so because of that, when you do timelines like this, where you're jumping around so much, it drives me a little crazy. Mm-hmm. I will say I'm very much in line with what Karen said. By the end of the book, I really appreciated it because, we'd see what Manisha did. And then like 2 days later or a day later, Pratyush would come in and would have an experience in that same place. And we kind of got to see what happened after Manisha left. So I agree with you there that I thought that was interesting and kind of connected them in a way that I haven't really seen, because I don't necessarily see that a lot in books where you have one character kind of following the other and you get the timelines kind of so closely lining up by the end.
Yeah, the beginning was kind of strange too, because I think it messed with his character development for me.
Mm.
There are a few lines like scattered here and there talking about how like the king can take any form that he wants to. Just the way that Pratyush was interacting with other characters in his, I guess, timeline. When you see him in Manisha's, I thought it was a completely different character. I thought it was the king like camouflaged as him, because the speaking mannerisms were completely different, or just like the way he portrayed himself felt different. And I think having the split with the timeline further removed him from even the moments that they did share together. And so I thought it was a little bit confusing. It could be just a me thing, but I think having closer timelines or maybe done something different might have been a little bit better for me.
I think if maybe there had been something tying their activities together, like, you know, they couldn't be in the same place. And she obviously wanted us to see like how far apart they are at the beginning, you know, after she leaves the Sky City. I'll just leave it at that. Like, you see just how far apart they are. I get why we were doing it that way, but like, yeah, I feel like it didn't lend itself to understanding, especially Pratyush's part of the story as well. And also, while we're just, before we get too far away, was anyone else kind of waiting for an explanation of who sent the monster to kill his parents?
A little bit. I
waited the whole book for something or someone to have been responsible for his parents' death, mm-hmm. because they wanted the next slayer and his dad refused, or, you know, was being a problem. And so they pushed him into that role. And like, I expected to find out that this character or this character was kind of responsible for it. And I don't feel like I ever got anything like that. And I just feel like it's a thread that I wish had been wrapped up. Like, it feels too random to have entered the story and his parents died that night, and that it, the monster just found them that day. Like, it happens to be the day that he first learns anything really about his history, because he overhears it, and it just happens, you know, like, it just felt too coincidental. You know, I still really liked the general story by the end, but I did have some frustration with that.
Mm-hmm. Two things. I guess I just assumed that the king sent the monster because he didn't want to deal with the father anymore. Maybe that was like slightly implied and I took it as gospel, and like,
well, I feel like, know, the king was supposed to have a larger part, or was like kind of being written around having a larger part, and then didn't. So that very well could be.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And it's also interesting. The other thing was you mentioning that the king could take any form. I don't remember them saying that in the book, but that also made me question Pratyush's like whole thing, because in Greek mythology, like, Poseidon is the one who sleeps with, rapes Medusa. And I don't remember if does he come as himself or is he disguised? I can't remember. But I kind of assumed that the person visiting her on the balcony wasn't actually Pratyush, that it was somebody in disguise.
Yeah, so like, yeah, that's the best word, disguise, rather than like take any form. It kept saying like you never knew when he would show up, he would be in disguise. And yes, that's exactly what it seemed like to me.
Yeah, so I think maybe that was a little bit purposeful to, because we obviously know from the beginning that these two are at odds. And then even though we're in Pratyush's head, I don't think we're fully meant to trust him or his motives. Like, even by the end of the book, I was like, I don't know, is he going to try to kill her? Like, he might, you know, even though it seems that he cares about her, he didn't know exactly who she was in the beginning. So that was always kind of sitting in the back of my head. And I think that was meant to throw us a little off balance.
Yeah. Or like at some point he lies, because he tells Manisha, like, I've never told anyone about this, but like, this is how my parents died. when like a chapter or two before he literally had just told someone about it. And that's why I also thought it was a different person. It's like, wait, what? So yeah, like he's a little shifty. Like I kind of like him, but he's also a little shifty.
Yeah. And one of the reasons why I said that the two of them, you know, even though they're worlds apart, kind of lead similar lives is that I think that they're both dealing with their own thing. And it could have been really easy for Sajni to mostly focus on Manisha and her story and what she's going through. But I actually really appreciated that she also put this magnifying glass on Pratyush and what he went through. There's this whole theme of men repressing their emotions, being told not to be weak. I like that the book didn't ignore the way that men are socialized to be strong. And even at one point in the story, somebody says, "You think girls are the only ones who get violated?" And I think that's an important part of this conversation as well.
You're not wrong. I didn't have the problems with trusting Pratyush that you guys did. I really believed that he was just looking for someone that he could like connect to and relate to. And because he didn't have anyone in his life really, other than that one soldier, and you know, like I feel like when he met Manisha and just felt different around her, that was enough for him to just kind of go a little bit crazy when he was near her and just needed to talk to her and learn more and whatever. So I didn't have as much trouble trusting that he was who he said he was. And so maybe that made me capable of like trusting him more in the book and seeing him as like the polar opposite of all these male characters that you run into throughout the story. And he's, you know, he's kind of the balance. He's the guy who's trying to do better because he's seen through his sister and through what happened with his parents, like he knows what it feels like to be alone and to have, you know, no power and all of that. So like, I feel like while he's the slayer and has that power, and in other aspects of his life, he's had no control and no power at all. So mm-hmm. I feel like because of that, I saw why Manisha and Pratyush were kind of like fated, but also ill-fated. Like they have something that kind of brings them together, but also so much pulling them apart. Yeah. And so I really did like his part in the story. I didn't have the trust issues with him that you guys did. And that's totally, I remember reading the disguise thing with the king, but I don't think it sunk in that like he could be someone else. So I just never even thought about it. And so, yeah, that never really factored into my reading of Pratyush. So that makes it a little different.
So what I'm hearing is Danielle and I have trust issues.
I mean, I'm not saying that. I just trusted him. Apparently, I'm naive and just like, this is the guy. This is the kid. He's going to be cool. We don't have to worry about him. Don't worry.
No, you're not. You're not. I another expectation of this book. I just thought it was going to be this girl like straight up murdering a bunch of men the whole time. And so, like, when we got Pratyush, like, that wasn't happening. I did settle into his story a little bit, but there was a little bit of just, oh, but all of the things that were happening to him or that he was, like, kind of dealing with, I was on board with it. I didn't see it as much of as a foil as you did until now that you're talking about it. I honestly didn't even connect him with Percy. Because I was just so here for murder that this conversation is really good because it's making me see him in a different light.
And
Karen does that for me all the time. She always makes me like people that I didn't realize I was going to like.
I don't know if that's a good thing, given my history of favorite characters and also real life people. But, you know. That's neither here nor there. There is no good segue into this next section. So nope. I'm just going to say that we do need to talk about Manisha's rape and the becoming of the Serpent Queen. And it's horrible for so many reasons. As difficult as it was to read, not just this, but the other rapes and assaults that happened throughout the book, because this is not the only one. Nope. I actually really appreciated the way that Sajni didn't shy away from the details. But at the same time, especially Manisha's rape, she experienced it how so many women do, as though it was an out-of-body experience. And so I don't want to use the word liked, but appreciated that, you know, she was explicit in what happened so that you couldn't write it off. You know, you had to confront what was happening to Manisha, but at the same time, you knew exactly what she felt like and how so many women feel when they go through this experience.
We know how it's not, I don't want to use the word important, but we know how like central this event in Medusa's story is to who Medusa is as a character that we know from mythology. So you can't shy away from this scene. And I agree with you. I think Sajni handled it very well. She did not shy away from what was happening. If the character can go through it at that age, then, you know, it's important that kids reading this book that are that age be able to get through it too, because, you know, it's something that happens in the world. It's not something we want to happen, but it is. So I think it's, you know, it's well handled by Sajni and a very difficult thing to handle. So I thought she did a really good job.
I am glad you said that, but I hate it at the same time, just because it's so true. I mean, there are girls who go through this who are younger than, I think Manisha is supposed to be like 16.
Yeah.
In this book. And there are girls and boys younger than her that go through this. And so, you know, with a lot of, we talk a lot with Rick Rod Presents and all of the, you know, there are certain books that focus a little more heavily on race and, you know, how people are treated, Kane Chronicles and Kwame's books and all of that sort of thing. If kids are old enough to experience that in real life, then kids are old enough to read about it in a book. And so, again, hate that this is the case, but
absolutely,
you're right. I mean, I think that it is important that for such a central part of Medusa's story that it is put on the page in this way.
And it also can inform just larger world views, mm-hmm. or like why some women hate men, or like why certain women act a certain way. It's awful to first realize that this is something that can happen, but it does lend a little bit of a different perspective than moving forward,
mm-hmm.
Which kind of goes back to what we were talking about before in terms of like the middle grade tone with the YA, which whether or not that was intended, it's the middle grade tone, but with a YA perspective. And so there is a little bit of that friction there.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not a bad friction to sort of have, because it ultimately leads to better understanding.
Right. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And I think this scene is multidimensional for a lot of reasons. One of which made me so mad was that Sita totally set her up for this. And I think that you're meant to understand that she didn't want Manisha to be raped exactly, but that she didn't really care what happened to her, and that she wanted her to appear defiled so that she could kick her out of the temple and out of being in Apsara. And
was the reason for that because she was like beautiful? Because people liked her? Like, did you get a sense as to why she immediately disliked her?
So there was like one line in there about how Sita kind of knew that she wasn't who she said she was. I think she kind of thought that maybe she was not necessarily a monster, but that she wasn't being truthful and that she was dangerous. But I wouldn't discount the fact that, yeah, she was also very beautiful and that people, I think Sita was jealous of the attention that Manisha would get when men in particular would visit and notice her.
Got it.
Yeah. I mean, that feels right.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel right, but it feels right.
Yeah.
It feels it real.
Correct. Yeah. Yeah. And I think that this is an important aspect of the book, too, because women perpetuate rape culture just as much as men can. I mean, the potential is there. And there's a lot to be said about victim blaming and the loss of innocence, equating, you know, defilement and shame. There's this quote in here that is just horrific, where Sita says, "Being defiled is a reflection on you, your blame, your shame, and your burden to carry. Why were you walking alone? What were you wearing? Did you maintain distance? Did you look at him in the eye for too long? Smile too eagerly? Give him any indication that he should touch you? You have no place among clean girls, much less a heavenly place such as this." And when you read it on the page like this, especially if you're less familiar with these circumstances in real life, you're like, that's ridiculous. That's a ridiculous sentiment that you could smile, you could look at somebody in the eye for too long, and therefore it's your fault. But like, literally, these are questions asked of women all the time when they go through these experiences. And so much blame is placed on the victims. And I was thinking a lot about how the language in this book is very stark. It's very in your face. There's no room for misinterpretation. And I think that some people could read it as, you know, oh, it's not like it's heightened for a book. It's not really like this in real life, except it is. And I think it's really important that Sajni is being so direct and really hitting you over the head with this sort of thing, because you cannot look away from what's happening.
Definitely true.
And another thing that I found very interesting that was also done with purpose was this quote as well. "The kingdom used words like defiled, unclean, unworthy, broken, dirty, used, but violated? That sounded violent, with a perpetrator and a victim, not as one-sided as the Apsara had taught." And that reminds me so much of the passive language that we see in headlines so often. And I just came up with like a ridiculous random thing that is not entirely what I mean, but I couldn't think of like a specific example. But like, woman dies after argument with husband. No, the woman was murdered. But like, especially with like headlines with Gaza and everything, we've been seeing this a lot with like, all these people are dying. No, all these people are being murdered.
Well, that's still passive, though, isn't it? Instead of like, this person murdered her.
Yeah.
Yes.
He murdered her.
In terms of passive language, but I also think it's really important. Yeah. The difference between like dies and murder.
The verb. Yes.
Are two very different sentiments. But you're absolutely right.
I just saw a TikTok like earlier today or yesterday, last night or something. The thing that's been going on in New York City where women are randomly being punched in the face. They keep giving headlines saying like women in New York are being punched in the face or whatever, but like they don't say men are punching women in the face. Like, this, you know, this is a thing that's happening. And this girl had done this TikTok where she was like, this, say what is going on. Like, it's because you're putting the woman at the beginning of the sentence, people immediately equate the action being the woman's fault. And by doing that, you're giving men the out, even though they are the perpetrators. And like, it falls right in line with the whole discussion here. Mm-hmm. But yeah,
that is a much better example of what I wanted to say. So thank
you. No, I think what you were saying was interesting because, yes, that different verb is important, but also it is so ingrained.
Yeah, it is.
To use it as a passive, like use the passive verb in those sorts of sentences that we get tripped up in doing it ourselves.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's true. 100%. Because yeah, until you hear the other, like the actual opposite, it's like, oh yeah, like that is a much better way of stating what is actually going on, but we're so ingrained to use the opposite that it just, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think another important aspect of this is when the general kicks her over the edge, it's so careless, it's so dismissive. The lack of remorse didn't surprise me, but it still made me so angry. But the worst part of this, and maybe I was misinterpreting this, but I feel like this had nothing to do with her. That the general raped her because Prakyush coveted her, because he kept talking about her, and the general was jealous of Pratyush. But instead of doing something against him, he does something against her.
Which is so Hera-coded, I can't even.
That is a truth statement.
Like, Hera does that stuff all the time, yes, where she yes. punishes the other. Yeah, it's like, come
it's on. Always the women. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, you're so right. Yeah, that's so interesting. And to see her as being disposable in that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm not sure if the emotion for me felt like jealousy, but it did feel like some sort of insecurity or even jealousy over Pratyush's level or just position within the kingdom or within mm-hmm. like the with favoritism. The yeah, with the king, yeah. Exactly. It's kind of just like, you know, kicking away a piece of garbage.
It's easier to take the person that Pratyush wants most and throw it away and make it, you know, get rid of Manisha and make her unworthy of his attention and hurt him in that way than it is to actually try and rise above what Pratyush is offering to the king. Because he can't. Because yeah. Pratyush is the slayer and like he literally can't. But like, it's easier to do this, so I'm going to do this. And that's, yeah.
Well, it's easier. And also, like, he doesn't know whether or not Pratyush will ever find out.
Right. Agree. Yeah.
Because, like, they, at that point, like, aren't going back.
But it also
they're leaving.
Takes away. Yeah, it takes away that the possibility of that for Pratyush, too, in the future. Yeah. Like, if, because he has said, like, I, you know, he wants to marry her. He wants to be with her. So, like, there's that hope in the future. And when he comes back and finds her not there, it's ultimately going to take that away, too. At the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
But luckily for Manisha, this is not the end of her story. She falls into a pit of snakes, which transform her into, you know, this serpent queen that she kind of becomes later on in the story. And it just like, you know, a woman scorned, like that phrase kept repeating over and over in my head. And I kept thinking about Kill Bill.
Of course.
And mm-hmm. how he really should have made sure that she was dead.
Of yeah. course.
So I think one of the biggest surprises for me was that this was not the only sexual assault in the book. There were several other instances where it came close to happening. It did happen. There was a lot of violence against women in this book. And in a way that made it very difficult to read. But on the other hand, it also made it so that Manisha's case isn't secluded. Like, it's not just this happened to her and that's it. Like, no, this is something that happens all over this land that they're living in. And I thought one of them in particular was very interesting because Pratyush stops one of his soldiers from raping a young girl. And this was also very graphic, not only in the way that the soldier kind of dragged her away and her father was begging him not to do that, but in the way that Pratyush and Dev confronted him. And basically, so Dev was the cannibal character. And
loved him.
I really liked him too.
Wanted more.
Yeah. And Dev basically threatened to rape this guy back and assault him with his knife. There's a quote here. I should let Dev have his way with you so you can learn another new word, consent. And Dev chortled and jammed the hilt of his dagger deep into the soldier's ... lower back. I was like, holy crap. Like, she is not pulling punches here.
Yeah. Like, she's being careful with her words because, you know, you need to, in order for this not to be an NA or adult book, you have to be aware of what you're saying. But she does not pull the actual punch. Like, what is happening on page comes across, even if you don't get the actual word.
I kind of want your guys' take on this scene. And I don't know, I feel like this is a much bigger discussion and one that could definitely be polarizing. But one, I think that the scene serves as a good example of how men should stand up to other men. That is really, really important. And also, I especially liked that this soldier was just crotch punch guy for the whole book. He didn't even get a name, which I thought was great. But the violence against violent people, I feel like is a conversation that could be very polarizing for a lot.
Agreed. Because like an eye for an eye isn't necessarily the best way to go about, you know, getting justice for things, but sometimes it's the only way to for people to really understand. And so for it to happen in a book, it opens the eyes of people reading what happened to this soldier in this scene. And, you know, it's you're seeing eye for an eye without it having to be a thing that happens in the real world. So, yes, definitely not necessarily the way we want to go about it, because being the perpetrator of it in order to get justice for something that's been done wrong is not necessarily the best answer, I don't think. And you're right. It's a very, very big conversation to have. But at the same time, especially the men in this story, from soldiers to random men you come across along the road, they are not feeling at all guilty about the things they're doing to all kinds of women in this story. So it is nice to see Pratyush standing up for a strange young girl who he does not know, and one of his soldiers who is being, you know, is perpetrating this, and him instantly taking her side and being like, no. And the other scene that really got me was the one with the mouths being sewn. I also liked the illustration of in that moment that Pratyush doesn't have an answer for that. And he's not always the ultimate good guy because he didn't know how to help them. And so he didn't help them. And like, you know, like in this situation, he is helping this girl and I'm glad he was there to do that. But he's not the, you know, the ultimate savior either, because he doesn't have answers for all of the violence and in some cases does walk away.
Yeah. And to kind of pull on it in a different way, and I know I'm not going to say this right, so please give me some grace for this, but
yeah.
And it's not a competition. But in this book, the depictions of physical murderous violence are so graphic. And there was actually a stark contrast to me with then the way that Manisha's rape was handled. Because yes, to all of the reasons that you guys were talking about how awful it is, because it is awful, and the way in which it is depicted is how a lot of women experienced it. But the fact that we can speak to other physical acts of violence in such a terrible and horrifying way, but still shy away or not completely have a one-to-one with how we depict rape in the set. Like, there's an interesting tension, I guess, that's going on there, because I thought, to me, the other acts of physical violence against women felt worse because they were depicted worse.
Mm-hmm.
The women with their, like you said, with their mouths sewn shut. And I think that was the same village where they would just like randomly take girls.
I was going to say the other main assault in the book is with Ronnie, who has her tongue cut out.
Yes.
And she is raped. And, you know, we don't see that, but we know that it's happened. And then that is, yeah, the same village where they're not only are their mouths sewn shut, but they're like worms that are like devouring their lips or something. It was so horrible.
It's so much more graphic.
But yeah, the whole worm eating the skin thing, like that just, it is almost worse and is worse than any of the description of Manisha's actual rape. Mm-hmm. Like it was more visceral and you could really just feel what was going on in that scene more than Manisha, for sure.
Other girls' rapes too, like you saw or felt more of the immediate aftermath.
Yeah.
Not saying that being kicked off a floating cloud and then getting all the bruises and stuff after that is not terrible, because it absolutely is. But there's something about the direct view of the immediate aftermath that it felt so different.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, it probably is affected by, this is Manisha's story and it's absolutely from her point of view. So if she experienced it as kind of an out of body thing, then that's how we experience it. But if,
great point.
If someone else had been watching, if Sita had been watching and we got it from her point of view, I wonder if it would have been as violently described as everyone else's. So mm-hmm.
That's a great point. I didn't consider that.
Yeah. I also want to bring up this idea of, you know, violence against violent people, and just mention Sweet Vicious and Promising Young Woman, both of which deal with this exact topic. And so if you're interested in kind of seeing other takes on that, and especially women getting, you know, their power back against rapists, those are one TV show and one movie that are good to watch.
Co-signed.
Yeah.
Okay, so I have some random things that I wanted to run through that I just thought would be, you know, interesting to talk about real quick. One is this: girls have to stick together. I found that there was far more examples of women sticking together simply because of this shared experience of womanhood, kind of like how you're loyal to like random women in the bathroom. And I felt that vibe like throughout the book, whenever she would go to a different village and then a young girl about her age would help her, because it's like, well, I know how you feel. I know, you know, how afraid you are right now. I know that you need help. Who am I to not help you when you need it? Like, I couldn't live with myself. And I really appreciated, especially after what Sita did to her. Yeah. I really appreciated seeing that throughout the book.
Agreed. Yeah.
Yeah. There was a lot of like giving of resources, which I think is the best way to depict it. It added more of a stark contrast between the women who then didn't help, or the times where they didn't help. Like, there was one character, I think it was the older sister in the village with the mouth getting sewn shut.
Okay.
Where we got to see what the consequences were, and Manisha like seemed close, and then Manisha just like went on her journey and walked away and like peaced out. And like, because of how close she gets then to other characters throughout the rest of the story, and how those women will come back and they're always supporting each other, that initial girl really stood out to me, because again, they were fostering this whole idea of women stick together, but this is the one that kind of like she was, but then kind of got left behind.
That actually surprised me. I'm glad that you brought that up, because she was literally debating like, oh, they're going to retaliate against them. Maybe I should go back. And then she just doesn't. And because of the timeline differences, I thought we would like figure out why they were punished and she didn't help. But like, we just never got that.
It seems like maybe Manisha just didn't wait long enough. It seemed to me like she'd waited there for like a day, or was like finishing up after a day. And then it took the men like 3 to 5 days to gather up their courage to then go beat again on the women.
Yeah.
And so that she was gone by that point. But yeah, it was a little unclear.
Yeah, definitely. I also appreciated how open the book was talking about menstruation, especially in the different villages. And you could see the different perspectives, like some believing that girls are unclean if they have their period, and some believing that this is lifeblood. And Mitali's village was kind of in the latter, and they even had stuff for abortions. And there was a moment where Manisha was like, wait a second, could I be pregnant? And she realized she's not because she's bleeding. But she also says, and if she was pregnant, she had a choice, a decision all her own. And it was like, yeah, that conversation is really relevant these days, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Or also, even starting the conversation as to like, what is menstruation? Because she didn't know, I don't think.
It seemed like Manisha had some understanding, but from her description of like how they handled it in the floating city was like, you got locked in your room until you were done bleeding. Because you were unclean, you could not be touched, or, you know, you couldn't be touched anyway, but like, you know, you were not to be near people while that was going on. So she probably didn't have the best understanding. And this girl that she comes across is like, here, have all of these things. This will help you. And by the way, my fortune that I don't have for that drug that shortens your period to like 6 hours.
I know.
Please, like, sign me up.
I'm sorry. What?
They gave her like a powder that was.
Oh, yeah, yeah, to, like, yeah. In the book. I thought that was real life. No. I was like, what?
No, I'm like, if we could like figure out how to make that like reality, that sounds fabulous.
Yeah, that would be so incredible. Like, yeah, hours instead of days.
Yeah.
Please.
Instead of all month. Yes, please.
Yeah.
Also totally random, the three village elders, the triplets, the Gray sisters.
Yeah, I thought it was so cool how she kind of weaved them in there. That was really neat.
I love that.
I thought of you.
Like, oh, did you?
I understood that reference, yeah.
Again, yeah, the way that she incorporated it into this village, but then, like, it was very clearly a reference to that. There were a few things where I kept kind of looking out for the Greek myth inspirations, because I'm more familiar with that than the Indian mythology. So I thought that was pretty cool. But one of the main themes of this book is that monstrosity is subjective, which just goes perfectly hand in hand with Percy Jackson season one. We talked about this quite extensively in our recaps, and I kind of love that we're reading this book now after the season is over, because there was just so much in here that I was like, yes, this is like what the show was talking about with Medusa, and even with Echidna, and, you know, her kids are the ones being killed by the demigods, and for her, the demigods are the monsters. And there's one quote here that I really liked. Some considered Nani a monster because she was of monstrous size and different. People feared what they didn't know, but Manisha knew her, and she was deserving of life, peace, and freedom. She had a heart as golden as her scales, a soul as bright as her eyes. Which was just a beautiful sentiment anyway.
Definitely. Yeah, it is really kind of perfect how well the monstrosity is subjective theme comes into play with Percy Jackson season one, especially because in the books, that's not really like a prevalent theme, but they definitely wove it into the show so well. And it's such a different and very interesting kind of way to frame that whole season. I liked how it was worked in here. I'll probably go more into detail with that in the spoiler section, because I think it works into the ending very, very well.
Mm. Yeah, and I think on that note, I was really interested in Manisha and Pratyush being monsters. Like, I kind of wonder, is he a monster who's just been raised to this pedestal of being a hero? Because they can heal really similarly. They're both like super strong. Like, the things that they could do are not all that different. And so I was like, what if the twist at the end of, I think this is meant to be a duology. It was sold as two books to Rick Riordan Presents. What if at the end he realizes like his lineage is also monsters?
A socially acceptable form of monster versus the socially unacceptable form of monster.
Like, yeah.
Manisha's it shows itself in this way. She is, you know, has venom and is, you know, everything that she is. And his version of it is accepted because he's the slayer of monsters. But like, he kind of has to be a little bit of a monster in order to slay them. Mm-hmm. So like, yeah, I definitely see what you're getting at there.
Or to sort of keep a little bit with like how the story is, it's the monster, the traditional unacceptable version of the monster in him that is keeping him from actually becoming the monster of his lineage, because then that kind of pulls in men. And so it's that piece of him that is keeping him from going full man.
Mm-hmm.
For lack of a better term, but nope. You know.
Yeah.
Definitely get it.
Yeah. I feel like that was a good segue into talking about female rage.
Great.
there's this quote here that says, her fear had finally ebbed away. He no longer held power over her because she took it back. And that power made her free, invincible, unbroken. She'd embraced her gifts, her rights, her darkness. And I think that is really important to talk about. And I don't really know how to word this, but like, I am somebody who tends to be very passive, very quiet. I genuinely do not like being angry. I don't like feeling anger. I don't like being mad at people. And even when I'm annoyed at people, I tend to turn it back on myself because, you know, that's how the world has socialized us. Mm-hmm. And especially lately, having gone through some stuff, I've been kind of embracing my own anger and, you know, about what's happened and the things that I've experienced and the time that was taken away from me to heal and stuff like that. And like, I didn't realize that there's so much power in just being mad about stuff and just allowing yourself to feel that anger. And so specifically, her saying that she embraced her darkness, like, really hit me very strongly. And I like that so much of this book, you know, A Drop of Venom, about her, like, she says at one point, I am Venom, which I couldn't not hear without thinking of the Venom movie.
Yeah.
yep.
Yeah. But I just really love that, you know, this isn't a story about, okay, Medusa's not this monster at all. No, Medusa, you know, still kills people, still hurts people. She has a reason for doing it. You know, she's not doing it just because she feels like it. She's reacting to these things, but she's embracing this part of her that she wasn't allowed to embrace for so long. She hid so much of herself. And I think it's important, especially as women, to understand that we are multifaceted and that we should be able to feel anger as loudly as men do, that we shouldn't have to, you know, push it down and hide it away.
Definitely. I too don't particularly love being angry. I like to get through it and move past it as fast as humanly possible because I don't like confrontation. And
yeah,
being angry means that usually you end up confronting someone. And I agree with you that I'm not very good at being angry. I definitely see what you're saying here. And I think it is important to kind of, you know, sometimes there's power in that anger and you have to allow yourself to like take it on and not just give it away as fast as possible so that you don't have to deal with it because it's uncomfortable. But yeah, it's definitely worth noting and worth talking about for sure.
Yeah, because if all that we get hit with constantly are forms of aggression, there's only so many times you are going to effectively counter that aggression with some sort of like passivity.
Yeah.
Sometimes you do have to fight back, but as women, that is not a lesson that is given to us ever. Mm-hmm. I didn't get a sit down like I see on so many different TV shows and movies, like, you know, work things out with your words, but you know, sometimes you just have to hit the kid is always a lesson in being better written. I'm not a writer.
Sometimes if you hit the bully, it takes one punch, then they feel it. And I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah. And that is never, if it is, it's very rare, but that is not a lesson that is afforded to us.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can't expect to feel equal or, I don't know, feel okay if you are constantly just going up against aggression with passivity. And so I like that this is embracing not passivity. Sometimes it absolutely is the right way to go, but sometimes being angry and standing your ground is the way to go. And, you know, sometimes we snap too.
Mm. Yeah. Which again is a good segue into the spoiler section.
Great.
So as always, if you don't want to know about the end of this book, stop listening now, skip to the outro. So, the general's death, was it slow and painful enough?
I don't know if it was slow and painful enough, because it should have been very slow and very painful, but I did love that she paid special attention to the family jewels. I feel like just watching him slowly turn to stone was not enough. And I kind of love that halfway through, like, she felt that extra urge to be like, you know what? This isn't strong enough. He's not feeling entirely how powerless I felt. Let's turn this up a notch. Like, I did appreciate that, because we saw him in the scene with Manisha where he rapes her. And then we see him throughout the book with Pratyush just kind of being very passive and like in the background doing terrible things, but like not really letting Pratyush see him do them. Mm-hmm, and so we don't see him being a terrible character throughout the book until you get to the end and you kind of realize all the things that he is responsible for and what he wants to do and, you know, how he wants to take over and be king and be able to, you know, keep wreaking the things that he does everywhere. He wants everyone to feel the way he does. And so, yeah, I really do love that Manisha sees, like, here's my opportunity to give him just a small sliver of what he put me through. And I'm glad that she turns it up a notch.
Danielle, you were really shaking your head when I asked that question.
Because, I mean, all of the reasons that Kristen said, like, I love where it started, but it almost seemed like the death itself, the actual act of dying, felt like it was trying to be slow and painful, but the context around it felt extremely rushed to me. Like, I loved the last fifth of the book. That's kind of how I wish the rest of it was, because like everything was together and now it's like firing on all cylinders, but they're not actually going head to head for long enough before that slow and painful death happens. So even though it's slow-ish, it feels fast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so I wish there was just a little bit, I wish there was more suffering. Honestly, I think maybe it was painful, but he just didn't seem to be suffering enough.
Mm-hmm. Which but. The very end made me happy. Like, when we learn kind of his ultimate fate, like,
right
after death, he's still not done. Like, I kind of love that there is something in the future that he doesn't see coming that is going to continue to punish him for his actions. So, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I kind of had an issue with Pratyush delivering that final blow. I mean, I understood where he was coming from and that he was angry on her behalf. But I also kind of felt like this was her moment, and he kind of stepped on her moment a little bit. And I think ideally there are a lot of different ways that it ultimately could have gone. But I think part of taking her power back could have been her turning her back on him and just walking away and leaving him to die alone, because it shows that she's not afraid of him anymore. She can turn her back on him and know that nothing's going to happen. And I think I would have preferred it to end that way instead of the way that it did.
Maybe it's just me. Maybe I'm just twisted enough. I didn't think that Pratyush's blow where he like caves in his face, I didn't think he was actually dead yet. So I liked to imagine that he was still slowly turning to stone, even though he didn't have a face anymore. He wasn't actually like dead until he was fully stone. So he was still feeling all that pain and that it was just more painful. So I didn't necessarily see it as a final blow. I was like, oh, like that had, you know, like that had to be even worse. And so, yeah, maybe that also played into it. Too much Criminal Minds.
I like that reading a lot because I think I was more in line with Karen, hoping that Cartouche would be more of like a Ben Wyatt, like allowing the strong woman in your life to do whatever she wants or needs to do. And your support of her is by standing aside and letting her do her thing. Mm-hmm. But I like your reading of it better.
More suffering.
Yes. More suffering.
Yay!
Did we like that this was kind of a low-key love story between these two, which is obviously very different from the Greek myth?
Yes.
And given the context of everything that happens with Manisha and also the role that Pratyush plays, how did you guys feel about their interest in each other?
As someone who thought Pratyush was like actually Pratyush at the beginning, I was a big fan. Like I liked him as a character, and I was glad that there was a possibility that like the two of them may find, you know, each other in the end. Like I was hoping. I'm a romance reader. It's what we do. I think I ultimately am really happy that the final pivot is that she wants to be friends. And she knows that he has stronger feelings for her than that. And she may get there. But like, Manisha is like, here's where I'm at. Here's where we're going to be for now. And we'll see what happens. I also love that, like, it is kind of a love story, but there's no, you know, kiss. There's no physical embodiment of their feelings for each other. And it's, I think it was the right choice because of all the physicality in this book being so brutal that if they would have kissed or done anything to really like physically show their affection for each other, it would have felt, I don't know if disingenuous is the word, but it just would have felt like wrong.
Mm-hmm.
I like that in the end, Manisha is just fully in control of herself and her body and her mind and is just like, here's where I'm at. She definitely has accepted that like he does want good things for her and that they have some sort of future in each other's lives and whatever that ends up being, it ends up being. But I did end up liking their story.
Yeah, I agree with that. I definitely was like, what's going on in the beginning? And then, you know, once I realized, okay, nothing's going on in the beginning, I kind of also fell in that line of like, okay, like I do kind of like them together. Like I wasn't totally convinced that something was going to happen at the end where like Pratyush was going to make a mistake and then he was going to become her villain, but I was really hoping that wasn't going to be the case because he genuinely seemed like somebody who would be very understanding of what she went through. And I completely agree with you that I really liked that ending because after everything she'd been through, she still had trouble bathing herself without feeling disgusted by her body. Him kissing her was never going to be realistic, but he touched her hand and she thought, oh, hey, I'm not recoiling at this. And to me, that was like, he's meeting her where she's at right now. And like, I think they're both aware that his feelings are greater than hers, but like, she literally can't do anything about that right now. She has to heal and go through a lot of things before she can get to that place. And the fact that like he wasn't upset about that, he didn't even question it, he didn't, you know, push her or anything like that, I think was really, it's really important to have somebody in your corner like that when you're on that journey.
Yeah, I agree with that. I like their dynamic together. I like the way that they like speak to each other, but they literally don't know each other. Like they don't know each other.
Aside from the fact, she even says that, doesn't she?
She does.
Yeah. Like, aside from the fact that I thought he was someone completely different for the first, like, half of the novel. Like, they're not together a ton when she's in the sky. And then we see them for a few hours, maybe, together-ish, but not the whole time at the end. And so, like, I liked their dynamic, and I'm here for their dynamic, whatever that might turn into. But I'm glad that it didn't go full romance, because it would not have made any sense to me. Yeah. And I don't like insta-love. And this would be, like, the insta-ist of insta-love.
Like, this book is in no way a Disney movie. So yeah. Let's not pretend that it is. Like, yeah. I like that we did not do that in the end. Yeah. Because you're right. Like, you know, Cinderella meets her prince, and a couple of hours later, it's like, I want to marry him. Let's do the whole thing. But, like,
Little Mermaid's not my favorite. That's right. Not this.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, that's thank not goodness. This story. And so, yeah, I think the ending was handled very, very well.
Mm-hmm. Was anyone else super glad that Noni was still alive?
Yes.
I was terrified.
I mean, I was a little broken that Noni, like, had died, quote unquote died. And I just loved that it was, like, the thing that he was so incessant, like, Manisha, you need to come with me. Like, he's just trying to show her that, like, your friend who I sort of maybe killed isn't dead. So don't hate me. Okay. I didn't yeah. know. And I just love that that kind of worked out that way.
Mm-hmm. I loved that scene. Yeah, him trying to communicate with her. It was yeah. great. More of that.
And like, yeah. yes, 100%. Because I thought it was like a mirage at first. Like, I thought it was one of his, like, I can hear dead people, see dead people, like the monsters I've slain and stuff. So like, I thought, oh, this confirms that she's really dead. And then she wasn't. And then she puked up Roz. And I was like, oh, even he's still alive.
Right.
Great. I think this was like my favorite scene in the book.
It
was,
you know, great. What? I'm with you. I forgot about it, but I'm with you.
Yeah. Okay. Last part of this is future books. Like I said, I believe this was sold as a duology. So we are definitely 100% getting a sequel. She even answered a question on Goodreads that we are getting a sequel. There were a few things in here that I thought were particularly interesting. Manisha says at one point, perhaps with friends like Deepa and the Slayer, Manisha could change her fate, which I really loved because, of course, we know what happens at the end of Medusa's story. And Sajni also said she was partially inspired by that statue of Medusa holding up Perseus's head. So, again, very interesting. I think the last line of the book was one a slayer, the other a monster, yet each was both. And again, I kind of am feeling more and more strongly that Pratush is actually a monster, and his ability is to, like, gain lives by slaying other monsters. Like, that's just his monster ability, but because it's useful, he gets to be the hero.
This was definitely my favorite quote from the book, for obvious reasons, but like, I love that in the end he kind of sees his own monster. Like, he yeah. sees that in her eyes he just slayed her best friend who didn't die, thank God. It kind of opens his eyes to the fact that he is the monster in all of these monster stories. And yeah, because he doesn't come across as a monster in most of the book. So like, for him to then acknowledge that, like, I am actually a monster is really interesting to me. And I love that she didn't really have to, like, tell him that. He came to that realization on his own, mm-hmm. In reflection to everything that was going on around him. So I really, really liked that quote and, like, that theme at the end there.
And then there's this final prophecy that we hear that says, future, this is from the three old ladies, Future ruler of Baroda, listen closely. Granddaughter of mine, keeper of histories, befriender of new rulers, riders of beasts, a new queen, one of three, risen from the blood river, who walks through nightmares unseen, ruby seeds clutched in her grasp, such treasures sought by kings, she who has walked the realm below realms and lived to tell the tale, who will snatch apart the court with vines that hum and speak secrets into her hands. She wears a crown of bramble dipped in red, the taste of blood fresh on her lips. Walking among those once thought to be dead, a touch of blood is all she needs. And we know by the end that Ashani's book is next. And like Kristen said, she is torturing the general in this moment, and who wants to place bets that the book is going to be called A Touch of Blood?
I mean,
it fits, right? A drop of venom, a touch of blood.
I would not be surprised if that was the title for sure.
Yeah.
I was surprised to learn it was a duology because I didn't know that going in. I wish I had, because it, like, you know how when you're reading a book and you're always like waiting for something else to come up and then it doesn't happen and you only learn at the end, it's because there's like another book coming.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of how I was with this a little bit. And then also, I don't understand. There's three sisters, but it's a duology.
Yeah.
Okay. My guess is since both sisters are kind of together at the end of the book, that it might be Ashani's story, but like the other sister like may factor into that story.
Mm-hmm.
That was my guess. Yeah.
She's the one wearing the crown of like broken glass and stuff. So
yeah.
There are three queens. She's definitely going to be in there somewhere. Also, let's remember, there are plenty of Rick Riordan Presents books where we thought that was the one and only, and they got like two sequels. So
yeah.
This was sold as a duology, but it's very possible that we could still get a third book.
Also true.
Well, that was our discussion of A Drop of Venom. I think that, you know, there was a lot to talk about and some really heavy topics, but hopefully you guys enjoyed that. Hopefully it was a stimulating conversation for you, and we're definitely interested in what you think of A Drop of Venom, and if you're looking forward to the next book,
let us know.
Kristen.
Prophecy Radio is produced by Subjectify Media. Follow our website on Twitter, Facebook, Tumblr, and Instagram at Subjectify Media, or visit us at subjectifymedia.com. You can find some of our other podcasts there as well, including Rewatchable, where we discuss our favorite canceled and cult classic TV shows, Not About the Weather, a general interest show that sometimes features conversations with our favorite creators, and Not Another Teen Wolf podcast, which includes exclusive interviews and in-depth analysis of both Teen Wolf and Wolfpack. You can contact Prophecy Radio directly on Twitter at Prophecy Podcast or on Instagram, Facebook, Threads, and Tumblr at Prophecy Radio Podcast. And you can email us your long-form thoughts to prophecyradiopodcast@gmail.com. You can find us and our episodes on Spotify, Apple, or any of your favorite podcast platforms. Please consider leaving us a review or a rating. 5-star reviews help others to find us, and we really appreciate them. You can leave us questions, comments, or ideas for episodes or content you want to hear from us in any of these places. We have two bits of feedback this week. The first is from Twitter. Go ahead, Karen.
Steph's Pensieve says, definitely agree with Aryan as Grover. Even in the behind the scenes, whenever he talked, I was like, yes, he is Grover. That's exactly what Grover would say.
I was going to say, this is obviously in response to our talking about Aryan kind of being like the ultimate embodiment of that character. We went on and on about that in our wrap-up discussion.
Yeah.
And yes, I think we're all in agreement. He was just so, so good.
Definitely.
And then our second bit is from Instagram and from a friend of the podcast, Riley. Those who are in the Facebook group probably have hung out a little bit with Riley there. But Riley commented on a story Karen posted, and I will let you handle that one too.
Yeah, I just randomly found this video, like scrolling through Instagram, of this woman who was putting on a whole bunch of different wedding dresses in relation to different characters from Percy Jackson. And like Echidna had one and Medusa had one. And there were all sorts of ones. Annabeth had one and they were all pretty cool. But a lot of people agreed. And Riley said that that we were all sad that there wasn't one for Grover, which I guess, Danielle, that's something you can look forward to in season two.
Yes.
I have a lot of questions about Grover in general. So we'll just add, why doesn't he have a dress to the list?
Yes.
That'll be fun.
But yes. By the way, I know that several of you have emailed us. I will be replying to your emails soon. It's just time's gotten away from me, but I know that they're there and I will respond.
We love you. Okay, so that pretty much wraps things up for us today. Next time, we're going to be talking with Roseanne A. Brown about season one of Percy Jackson, as well as possibly season two and her book as well. So we're very much looking forward to having her back on the podcast. Yes. She is so much fun.
Yeah. And also, just FYI, if you want to hear more of Danielle, she is on a lot of episodes of Rewatchable.
Yes.
So if you haven't gone back and listened to that yet, then you can hear us become best friends in real time.
Very cute. It starts in Veronica Mars. Or if you'd like to jump to Sense8, there's an episode where I do the entire intro while singing.
We got up to some interesting things on Rewatchable.
Our hijinks are so great.
They are. They really are.
Oh, you were reading out that section and I was like, oh, I miss it. But also I do have to note before this all signs off, listening to these podcasts, I have never been sure as to whether or not you just had a clip that you would insert with Kristen, you reading all of the outro. Like the contact information, because you just nail it every single time in the same way.
Yeah.
And so now I have witnessed it live and I can tell everyone out there that it is not a recording.
Yeah.
A previous recording. She does it live.
I read it live every time. I've thought about saying, you know, we could probably just cut that from last week's episode and put it in there, but it's honestly just as easy to read it every time.
Yeah.
But once you get into a pattern, you just kind of read it the same way every time. And my voice goes up and down in exactly the same places.
Same thing with the intro. When I do that intro, I say it the same way, like every time.
It's just, hey, it just works. Whatever.
You guys are true professionals. You rock.
Thank you. You are too. Thanks for coming on our podcast. And obviously you are welcome back anytime. So.
Thank you for having me on your Percy Jackson podcast. Me, a person who has never opened a Percy Jackson book.
That's okay. Percy Jackson fans start in all kinds of ways.
Yes.
I appreciate you.
All right. So, yeah, until next time, this is Kristen.
And I'm Karen.
And I'm Danielle.
And we're Prophecy Radio, signing off. Over and out.